And welcome. You're listening to the first episode of Start Making Sense here on 2SER
107.3. Okay, so I think maybe we should start with where we are, because we're not at 2SER.
No, we are definitely not in a radio station at the moment. We are at home with a very makeshift piecemeal studio.
Practicing adequate social distancing.
We have a cup of tea and we're going to do a community radio pop-up show.
Okay, so who are we?
It's hard to introduce yourself in a way that doesn't sound like you have an inflated sense of self. My name is Shane Anderson. I am a audio producer, and also I am studying towards a PhD at the University of Technology, Sydney.
Cool. What do you research?
That's such a tough question to ask someone researching for a doctorate. I am basically looking at, I guess, how we talk about technology and the way our kind of pre-existing world goes into how we talk about technology and what we think our relationship to technology is.
I'm Miles Herbert. I'm also a longtime community radio maker, and I'm also doing a PhD at University of Technology, Sydney. And the stuff I research is kind of how communities gather online, how people use audio and technology to form spaces and speak to each other. So what are we doing on people's radio?
That is such a good question, but we wanted to get together to make this space where we could kind of talk about some of the changes that are happening now. Obviously, there is a terrifying global pandemic. It's impacting everything from politics, economics, everything we do. The fabric of our everyday lives is completely changing, and technology is playing a really big role in that.
And I think more than anything, as Australia goes into stage 3 lockdowns and everyone is practicing social distancing and the people who are supposed to be out and about are only supposed to be essential workers. And since that has happened, it has become unsafe for people to come in to the radio station at 2SER. So program makers around the country, and specifically in Sydney, are now just broadcasting from their living rooms. And we have that luxury. We have the luxury of being able to broadcast from here. So I think that's what we're going to do. We are going to hunker down, and we are going to try and process everything that's happening out in the world in front of this microphone. I think during this pandemic, people are turning to the news sites they trust the most. I think people are in need of good quality information during this time. And I think people are getting that information. They are reading numbers about new confirmed cases. They're reading numbers about the impact on our health system. They're getting that information from a variety of news sources. But I think what we want to do is just maybe dig a little deeper and see how all of this stuff is affecting our society in the long term and what new things are happening all around us because of this pandemic.
With that in mind, I decided for this first episode, it might be interesting to chat to Axel Bruns.
Sure. My name's Axel Bruns, and I'm a professor in the Digital Media Research Center at QUT, where I do social media research and investigate the intersections.
He does a lot of social media research, kind of at the intersection of news and journalism. And he's documented this shift of our lives and our information going from offline to online.
All right. So what did Axel say?
There's a sad irony in many ways that when we talk about the way that information spreads in these platforms, we actually use the term contagion as well.
We already use the language of a pandemic to talk about the way information travels online.
In some ways, the way that information spreads across social networks isn't all that different from the way that information spreads, that virus is spread between people in their physical social networks as well.
And that seems really obvious. We talk about something going viral, and then we talk about the virus happening at the moment. But there is a lot you can draw from this comparison of the way information spreads through human societies through these digital technologies.
I think really it is because in many ways, when we talk about social media, we talk about social processes, of course, and that may be online and it might be computer mediated, but it's still very much a social process and actually doesn't work all that differently, ultimately, just at a larger scale from your offline social networks as they've existed for millennia, really.
So basically, the pathology of how information spreads is similar to the pathology of how viruses spread?
Yeah, totally.
And of course, viruses and other illnesses spread via those social networks as well. We've got to be in physical contact in order for me to give you coronavirus or vice versa. So in many ways, it still works very much on that basis. Ultimately, what we're talking about is a network of people who connect in various forms, and some connections are stronger than others, some connections are more frequent than others. So through that, information as well as in a physical sense, viruses can spread more easily. That's I think where that is so easy to translate from one to the other. And of course, the World Health Organization, as soon as they talked about an epidemic or a pandemic, actually also started to use the term infodemic, which basically is their way of saying, well, we've got to be careful not just about the spread of the virus itself, but about the spread of information, false information, particularly about the virus.
So what does he say about information about the coronavirus? How does that spread? How do people talk about it?
Yeah, so in terms of the coronavirus on social media, it first began in Wuhan, China, in, I think, early December.
I think probably with the early rumors in China, there seems to have been quite a bit of early information about this mysterious outbreak of whatever it was, which was unknown at the time, of course, in Chinese social media platforms on Weibo and WeChat.
Where information about this new SARS-like virus started spreading on Chinese social media, so that's like WeChat and Weibo, and it was spreading before the government had officially announced that there was anything going on.
The market closure was the first clue that something was amiss. Not that Wuhan's residents were officially told anything. But doctors at Wuhan's Central Hospital...
So initially, the state response was pretty hush-hush, but people were taking to social media. Like, doctors were taking to social media and becoming whistleblowers, basically trying to get the word out that there was this weird new disease and that people should be paying attention to it and that people should know that it's out there.
One of them was Dr. Li Wanliang.
There are 7 confirmed cases of SARS at Huanan Seafood Market. They are being isolated in our hospital's emergency department in Houhu Hospital District.
So it's like, humans are carriers of the virus, but these social platforms that people operate on are the carriers of this information?
Yeah, pretty much. So it moves from these Chinese social media apps. It then becomes official news.
Then, on the 20th of January, the government finally confirmed what many suspected.
This is when it starts popping up on Facebook and Twitter. Also, TikTok has been a huge source.
Ireland, Russia, Oman, Bulgaria, Saudi Arabia, Hungary, Cyprus, Iraq, and Iran.
And also, people's private networks like Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp. And this is where Axel starts to describe the spread of coronavirus as a complex contagion.
What does that mean?
Such a good question, Miles.
We tend to distinguish what's called simple and complex contagion. Simple contagion is where I have a piece of information, I post it somewhere, and you pick it up and you have it now as well. Whereas complex contagion needs a number of contacts with that piece of information before you actually start to believe in it as well. And often with these rumors about something going on, it's actually that complex process.
A simple contagion would be if I am living at home with my sister and I sneeze and she picks up the disease from me. It's like a one-to-one transmission. But a complex contagion would be something like an urban legend or like a hairstyle. So like if you are out on the street and suddenly everyone's got pastel pink hair, a part of you might start to think, oh, I should dye my hair pastel pink, although please don't. So this is be your complex contagion that is reinforced by the environment around you.
Just because some person who I've never heard of before now says there's a virus in Wuhan doesn't mean that I'm going to believe it. But if I start seeing it from multiple sources, when I start seeing it perhaps from journalists or others who I have a higher level of trust in, then I'm starting to believe it.
That's where we can see this health misinformation coming into the picture.
And what Axel is saying is this complex contagion is not only happening with the virus, it's also happening with the information about the virus.
Yeah, so you've basically got these super spreaders. I don't want to go too far into these metaphors, but these people who are well connected through different communities on different social media platforms.
People who are active across multiple platforms actually play a particularly important role in spreading information as well.
Yeah, so they're like the super spreaders.
In a sense, yes. I mean, we've got to be careful not to make this too much just based on metaphors for actual viral contagion, of course. But yes, in many ways, the people who are best connected, the people who have connections into multiple networks, into multiple communities as well. So the people who have relatives in China and who have relatives in Australia, or the people who are interested in politics as well as health, as well as sports or whatever, they might be people who are particularly important in connecting these different communities together and actually sharing information from one group to another as well.
Yeah, I think every podcast I listen to, whether it's football or the New York Times, everything I listen to, everyone I follow on social media is talking about coronavirus, right?
Yeah, and I think sports podcasts are a really interesting example. So not to out you, but you do listen to a lot of football podcasts.
I do. And honestly, because football has shut down and so much of our lives are shut down, everything that you would normally turn to, I think, is really coronavirus focused. You know, it's like the only thing people are reading, and you end up with people who are not expert virologists. You know, you have people who are football commentators talking about coronavirus all day, every day, and they're spending a lot of time spreading information about coronavirus, whether that is good information or bad information. You know, you have people who necessarily aren't qualified spreading this information to massive audiences.
And that's exactly it. That's the risk with an infodemic, is that there is so much information, it's hard to pick out what's good information and what's bad information. And that's where we kind of end up in this weird area of the health misinformation that's been going viral on these platforms over the past couple months. Yeah, so what's the risk there in an infodemic?
Well, misinformation to start with, not even so much active disinformation, which means, you know, information that's designed to cause harm, but even just misinformation that might be well-intentioned but is just wrong.
The WHO says false information about prevention measures or fake so-called cures are potentially harmful to public health. It's using the hashtag KnowTheFacts to dispel...
Particularly at a time of rumors, when you don't really know yet what exactly is going on, what you can trust... That information spreads quite easily because it fills an information vacuum, basically.
Concerns that pets can spread the coronavirus to people. There's no published evidence of that. Another fake fact that it's unsafe to receive packages from China, or that sesame oil, garlic, or gargling mouthwash can protect you. No evidence of that either.
And this is definitely not new in Australia, right? Misinformation is not new.
Absolutely not. And I think one thing that's interesting to me about this is when we look at something like misinformation on social media, we tend to think of things like the US election in 2016, where it was these like evil Russian bots in factories, like out there trying to influence politics. But with this pandemic, a lot of the information is coming through on like WhatsApp voice messages from people you trust, from people who seem trustworthy. And it's got this veneer of like friends helping out friends.
Yeah, I think that's true. And again, it depends obviously on the event as well, just in terms of whether it's something that affects you directly or whether it's just something far away somewhere else in the world that you can just spread rumors about. So it's one thing for us in Australia to sit here and talk about whether the Russians were involved in the 2016 US election or whatever. It's not something that most of us have any kind of direct experience of, and it doesn't necessarily affect us immediately either. Rumors about how we should practice social distancing and all these sorts of things, that is something now that very directly affects us. And so, yes, we do we do actually seek out information, of course, about what we should be doing and how we can protect ourselves, because we are directly afraid of the virus.
Over the past couple of years, there's been this shift, right, away from public Facebook posts, away from public Twitter posts, into our private social circles. And this is where like WhatsApp and Messenger come in. And at the same time, we've seen this shift away from like evil Russian bots in, you know, computer factories in Russia trying to influence politics, over to kind of just friends sharing information that seems like it could be legit and that people are sharing because they want to help you out.
And I think people already have the pathways and the sources that they get information built into their daily lives, right? So I know for me and for a lot of people, you know, convincing my grandparents to stay in, you know, convincing my parents, you know, I'm not sure about you, but I feel like my parents and grandparents were just sending me the most heinous misinformation on WhatsApp.
And it's with the best intentions. So you've got this information that people are sharing of these rumors like, you know, sunlight and some dangerous ones like huffing firecrackers, which nobody should do. And then you've also got bad actors.
Clearly there are some people out there as well who are looking to profit from the crisis in one form or another, whether that is by, you know, hawking supposed cures for corona that don't work, or, you know, masks that don't work or whatever else it might be, or by just creating fear and anxiety for political gains, for instance. So I think that's something that's probably just worth saying we should all be very, very careful about.
So with that in mind, what are social media companies doing about this? How are they dealing with this?
From what I know from platforms like Facebook and Twitter particularly, they have stepped up their attempts to ban some content that they think is clearly problematic, whether that's just hate speech and racism and so on, or medical misinformation as well. That's always difficult to do because that can take many forms, and particularly when they're using automated detection mechanisms, of course, they take a while to train and to become successful at identifying this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I did see that Facebook's automated detection algorithm took down a speech from the Brazilian president.
Yeah, and that's you know, that's appropriate in that case because he has been spreading really egregious misinformation about the virus. But it also becomes problematic because if a mainstream media outlet is reporting what the Brazilian president is saying and is clearly reporting this as being misinformation, should that also be taken down, or would an algorithm also take this down because the article might still contain those statements even though they're being debunked?
There has been people who are just racist and seeking to benefit from sharing racist information. For example, BuzzFeed reported that there were people making fake Facebook accounts pretending to be an Asian woman who was recruiting people to buy toilet paper. Now, it was shared really widely on right-wing social network groups. Even Peter Dutton was tagged in a couple tweets. But a pretty basic search could show you that the profile picture that was used was just what comes up in Google Image when you search Chinese lady. And it was originally from someone's Airbnb profile.
I think what we're seeing is just the things that play out in our society day to day. They're amplified because we're living our lives online more.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the role of social media in our lives and how we've really, really quickly gone from like having an online life and an offline life to mostly having an online life. So how has it become your life?
Well, I think it's a lifeline for a lot of us, and myself included, because, yeah, we are now disconnected from our social contacts, whether that's family, friends, workmates, anything else. This is the only way that I'm seeing people outside of my immediate family who live with me, whether it's Zoom or Skype or anything else. It's actually really, really crucial for us to have that face-to-face interpersonal contact. To the social media platforms more broadly, so Facebook and Twitter and all the others, they are also a way to relieve some of the stress and the pressure and just at least get a sense that you're not alone in this as well. I've seen a few, tweets and posts from journalists saying, well, oh, everyone on social media is so cynical of the government, or it's just making fun of whatever Scott Morrison's doing or not doing or whatever. I think that's actually misunderstanding the role of these platforms, though, because to some extent, this is where we let off steam, where we say, you're not moving fast enough, or you're moving too fast, or whatever it might be, where we are able to have a discussion about what's going on. And it's a discussion that we can't have anymore, in the office as we're standing in line for our coffees or whatever else it might be. This is now the only place where we can still really have that discussion. And it's an important one because we need it in order to make sense of what's going on for all of us, and perhaps to help others make sense of what's going on as well. What happens, of course, after this crisis is over, eventually, whenever that might happen, so are we then all just going to go back to doing these things offline? Is the symphony orchestra going to move back offline and into the concert hall? Well, probably in that case, but for a few others who have found new ways of operating online, well, maybe some of that will stick around.
I really, really appreciate you taking the time. I know it's a really stressful, busy time for everyone.
Well, it's going to be like that for a while, I think, too. So
yeah,
we'll just have to get used to it, I guess.
So I think for me, all this stuff really makes me think about what we're sacrificing in the name of this new digital connectivity. Over the last few weeks, Australians have sacrificed a lot. Shops have closed, and police have been given broad powers to criminalize people really without cause. And we have all kind of just accepted it because we know we need to stop this virus. And I think the same thing is happening online. We need to work. We need to talk to our coworkers. We need to speak to our family. And the way we do that is through these digital platforms. And like we just talked about, they already have major issues with privacy. Even before this massive uptake in users. So I think for me, all this stuff is just going to continue to play out and continue to play out as we, all of our lives are just moved more and more online.
Yeah, it's a conversation that we need to have about the trade-offs between kind of the health and security of the community versus this huge potential for increased surveillance. And it's something that's been on the back burner for a while because these platforms have an incredible capacity to essentially spy on our every move and turn that into data that then gets turned into profit. There's already been talk about the Australian government using mobile phone location data to track whether or not people are obeying the quarantine and the lockdown, which on the one hand, you're like, yeah, people should be doing that. People should be respecting the needs of the community. But at the same time, these are the kind of laws that don't tend to get rolled back once the crisis is over.
You know, some of the stuff we talked about today are small issues. That issue is a pretty big one. But I think more of these issues are going to pop up. So I think as long as we're stuck at home, we're going to be trying to make sense of this pandemic and make sense of the way our lives look now.
Society is changing, and how things are going to look from now on is going to be different. And it's that change that we want to try and document in some form.
I'm just going to keep the recorder on, and hopefully you guys will listen and enjoy the show.
That was the first episode of Start Making Sense. You're listening to 2SER 107.3. We'll be back next week with some fresh episodes. Hopefully we'll be available soon as a podcast. Thank you for listening.
Wow, Aida Soplo, Bolbia Man.